Like most storytellers, Anansi was very concerned with form, beat, timing. Whatever you chose to call it, a story needs a beginning, a middle, and an end. Anansi had seen the beginning of the world, that elusive event men were forever trying to describe. The storyteller's mind chose to call that the beginning. Not for gods, of course. The gods had their own beginning, a story Anansi would never tell. But it was a beginning for these beings, the ones whose presence on the face of the world had been most impactful. With that perspective, Anansi tracked the story of those he followed from that loud moment of conception. But now, he felt like he was living another beginning. And while Anansi was not one for cheating, at least not when it came to storytelling, it did make sense to assign to this new event the chains, the whips, the black bodies toiling in the field, the white bodies in their dance of gentility. It made sense to call this new thing a kind of beginning as well. In the beginning, there was sugarcane and cotton fields. Men and women toiled to fuel a machine that it would take generations for them to fully understand. On the first day, there was the water, and it was without shape or form. The water that first separated many worlds from each other so they could all exist. Until the people learned to conquer the water, and as a result, each other. Now the water consumed the bodies that fell from the ship like a hungry beast. On the seventh and final day, resistance was born, because those who worked the fields could never rest. It was conceived in the beating of drums and the clever words of songs, chants, war cries that the followers of Anansi could shout out as they attacked the sugarcane and the cotton. But it was more than an attack on the fields. It was an attack on the new world itself, the one that had not been created by gods, but by greed. And so really, in the beginning, there was war. Welcome. I am History, and this is the final chapter of our story. If you have arrived at this point by some other path than chronologically, we will wait while you retrace your steps, listen to chapters 1 through 4, and come back to us the right way. When we last spoke, Kamau had destroyed the Comb Plantation and joined the runaway slaves, the Maroons, in the mountains. His mind had been broken by Asa's death. Most experts agree that this is as much a side effect of the heartbreak as well as the violent severing of the psychic link between the two of them. News of Kamau's deeds had spread quickly to the colonial powers, and the sovereign under whose dominion the island currently fell, King George, had sent word for his own infamous monster hunter. The English, like many other European nations, had some knowledge of the hidden world on the African continent. There are numerous records from explorers and merchants that outline encounters with creatures from the hidden world. The most famous of these, the Diary of Edward Drudge, chronicles an encounter with a Buddha, the werehyena destroyed the contingent of 12 well-trained soldiers and left Edward Drudge as the sole survivor. So it is safe to assume that when the court heard of the single man who had destroyed an entire plantation, they suspected that he was more than just a rogue runaway. Just like today, there are very few people equipped to respond to this kind of threat. An examination of those employed by the various royals at this time show that the more powerful nations at the time, Britain, France, and the Dutch, each had a single contingent that seems to be dedicated to this purpose. This is a safe assumption for two reasons. The first is that while records of this kind are usually filled with specific examples of exploits and meticulously listed titles and lands, in each case, the special services provided by these well-funded groups with little oversight were very broadly stated. These duties were usually explained in biblical terms. For example, the English referred to their group only as the contingent, and their duties involved ridding the earth of all who would perform service in the name of the devil. The irony of this statement within the context of slave trading might have been lost on them, but today it is almost comical. The second thing that made groups like the contingent so remarkable was that, in every case, the majority of the members were Africans. The list of blacks who were employed in any capacity by any European power was almost non-existent. But in this case, the French, the Dutch, and the English all had a group of highly placed agents who were members of different African tribes. So the request had been made for the contingent to visit the island and address a problem that had, until then, been isolated only to the alleged Dark Continent. But it would take some time before this group could be relocated, and the court was impatient, so first they dispatched the army. The Five-Day War is a well-documented event in the island's history. The English dispatched 5,000 soldiers under the command of Joffrey Fraser. Fraser had been a lieutenant in the War of the Spanish Succession and was such an effective soldier that he had been pulled away and commanded to bring order back to the island. By examining dispatches from various soldiers, as well as the newspaper reports of the time, we can piece together a fairly comprehensive timeline. The army arrived on a Friday. It was raining. They were greeted by Governor William Selwyn Esquire, the Crown's representative on the island. The governor was hesitant to enter into open conflict with the Maroons, since all evidence suggested that was where the offender had fled. But they all had their orders, and on Monday morning, the soldiers marched on the mountains headed for Nannytown. Nanny and her Maroons stopped them before they could get to the settlement. It is reported that there were no more than 200 Maroons, but Nanny's forces were no ordinary fighters. In addition to her supernatural powers, about which very little specifics are available, Nanny and her fighters were bullet catchers. This is an ancient practice that many believe she brought with her from her original tribe. If the idea of 200 or so runaway slaves catching and redirecting thousands of bullets to stiff-lipped English soldiers seems almost impossible, it was equally disconcerting to the survivors of this war, many of whom would return home and be dubbed as lunatics because of their wild stories. Kamau was not present at this battle, but the Maroons did not need him. They had been fighting soldiers for years and would continue to do so until the end of slavery. Like any army faced with an enemy with superior numbers and technology, the Maroons employed guerrilla fighting strategies. They ambushed the British soldiers who were not familiar with the mountains, driving them into well-placed traps, off the edges of cliffs, or into deep river water. Still, the Five-Day War was a warning for Nanny and her Maroon army. The Maroon civilization had grown so large and complex that they often needed to make their own truce with the planters. For years, they had been involved in a tense dance with the English or whatever colonial power happened to be in control of the island at the moment, and now Kamau's actions and his presence at Nannytown was forcing them back into open conflict. The oral histories recorded by the Maroons indicate that a few weeks after the Five-Day War, the Obaifo left Nannytown. By then, he was fully recovered. They did not know where he was going. It was hoped that with this action, they could avoid all-out war with the British. The infamous contingent and its even more infamous leader, Hunter, arrived on the island exactly 1 month after the Five-Day War. In a grotesque bit of symbolism, they were transported by a slave ship, which was the most expedient way to get them from the African village where they were doing their bloody work to where they needed to be. Hunter is as intriguing a personality as Kamau himself. Very little is known about his background. Like the other members of the contingent, he was undoubtedly recruited because he was already the monster hunter for his village. In exchange for their services, the villages and families of the contingent were spared the raids of other slavers, branded with the Crown's insignia, and therefore untouchable. Hunter, which is the only name he would give to those he met, was a physically striking personality, and there are numerous descriptions of him written by governors, sailors, and unfortunate black men who crossed his path. He was about 6'8" tall, with a shaved head. He was solidly built, and his body was covered in markings from his neck to his toes. The most notable thing about Hunter, however, was the deep scar across his face that drew a line from the top of his head across his eye and nose, and ended at the cheek on the opposite side. The rest of the contingent were equally colorful and fearsome men and women, but Hunter was their leader and by far the most imposing. As a representative of the crown, it was natural for Hunter to meet with the island's governor. And so, he became the first black man hosted at the governor's mansion. Not with tea and cakes, of course. The governor Selwyn proudly writes in his autobiography that he, quote, met the dog at the door and spoke to him in a manner necessitated by our respective standings. I did not know what service this brute could offer when the noble men in His Majesty's army had failed. But Hunter was unfazed by the governor's hostility, and their exchange was a short one that left Selwyn flustered and uncertain how to proceed. Selwyn writes, quote, the man who identified himself as Hunter told me to pull all my soldiers back. I protested that he did not know the area or even the face of the man he was looking for. I explained to him that the mountains were filled with runaways and identifying a single man would be difficult. He just laughed, making a hollow sound and causing the deep scar across his face to crinkle. He assured me that he knew very well what the man looked like, and even then, his people planned to kill everything in the mountains without regard. He finished by stating that it would be best if I pulled all my soldiers back, because he'd rather not kill any English in the process. Then he turned and left. I was shocked at the brevity and audacity, but I did not expect what would come next. Selwyn goes on to describe the events, and in the conclusion of the book, it is the arrival of the contingent, and Hunter especially, that he identified as the turning point in the island's history. The stories that come as a result of Hunter entering the mountain in search of Kamau were ignored by historians for years. They form the next logical volume in our created history, as we attempt to paint a picture of what happens when society's greatest sins disturbed an ancient ecosystem and the explosive impact on a small Caribbean island. And with that, I must take my leave. Thanks for listening. Perhaps we will continue to explore these stories in the future, if like Anansi, you too are willing to follow them to uncomfortable and terrifying places.